Welcome to the Big Three podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymere Baptist. The Big Three pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymerebaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, welcome to The Big Three. My name is Mark Rader. I am the senior pastor here at Guymere Baptist Church and your host for the next half hour as we unpack three questions from Sunday's sermon. We are in the school holidays at this point in time, and so we have decided to run a short series just for the 3 weeks of the school holidays that we've entitled Kingdom Tide. It is a term that's not particularly familiar to us, but is used to describe this period of the church calendar. That's the church universal rather than Guymere Baptist Church. It's the season in which the church has traditionally focused on growth, maturity, fruitfulness as followers of Jesus. And so we have decided that we would focus on those themes for these 3 weeks in particular, and that we would also pick up and use the lectionary readings as the basis for our messages in this series as well. And so on Sunday, I actually used two of the passages that are found in the lectionary. I talked about Psalm 82, which is a fairly unusual psalm in the sense that it sets the speech of God in the assembly of the gods and then reflected on the Good Samaritan in Luke chapter 10, the common theme being the issue of justice. In Psalm 82, the Lord accuses the gods of failing to bring justice and therefore judges them on that basis. And obviously in the parable of the Good Samaritan, Jesus speaks about the importance of loving neighbor as one of the foundations upon which our lives ought to be based. So we've got some questions that have come out of that, and they kind of relate to all the things I just spoke about. So I'm going to answer these three. First is, what is the lectionary and why are we only following it now? Which is a good question on two levels, about what that is, but also, you know, why we're choosing to do now, why don't we follow it more regularly, all those sorts of things. So I'll speak briefly about that. The second question is, did the Israelites believe that the other gods were real? This relates to, I'm assuming, Psalm 82 and the assembly of the gods and the scene that's set and used there. And the question, you know, when you get to the New Testament, you know, Paul kind of talks about, you know, the gods being, you know, useless or kind of fronts for demonic activity or whatever the case might be. What did the ancient Israelites believe? So it's a great question to deal with. And then this one, Psalm 82 calls us to defend the vulnerable, and Luke 10 shows embodied mercy. Are we too comfortable in giving money than offering ourselves in the work of love? Which is an excellent question for us to wrap up with today. An opportunity to reflect really on the central theme of Kingdom Tide, the growth and fruitfulness and maturity as followers of Jesus. So looking forward to getting stuck into these questions. So let's begin. So we are a Baptist church, and as such, tend to be marked and characterized by a few things. One of them is about how we baptize people and the beliefs that we have around baptism for believers and whatnot. Another is that Baptist churches are locally autonomous, and so every Baptist church kind of does their own thing in lots of ways, although there's some commonalities in how we do that. We believe in congregational government, that while there may be pastors or elders or deacons or others who are delegated with authority to make decisions, that ultimately the governance of the church ought to be by the membership, all of whom have been given the Holy Spirit, all of whom as baptized believers have committed to following Jesus. But the ways in which Baptist churches tend to function is kind of independently from a worship perspective and a liturgy perspective. So most Baptist churches that you would find We'll have a I guess a default liturgy, a way in which their services unfold. I mean, you've been to a church service, you've probably noted this, right? There's a welcome or a call to worship. There's a few songs of worship. There's probably some announcements and prayer and a Bible reading and a message, and maybe there's communion or some other aspect in the service, and then they kind of finish with a song. Right? That's kind of a liturgy. The lectionary is a slightly more formalized component of liturgy. I don't know when it began. I should have looked it up beforehand, I suppose, and you can probably fact check me even as you're listening. But I want to say that it's over 1,000 years old. My recollection at this point is that during the reforms of Charles the Great, Charlemagne, that his reforms, which included all sorts of reforms, but religious reforms were one of them. I want to say that the lectionary has its roots in those reforms, that there was a sense that there would be benefit in some standardizing of the ways in which churches across his empire dealt with and worked their way through Scripture. Now, the lectionary readings that we have today are, I'm not sure what the connection is with Charlemagne's reforms, if that's indeed the roots of it. I think it is. But they're essentially, the ones that we're using are part of a fairly broad, I don't know who, which denomination started them, to tell you the truth, or which denomination works with them. But I know that, say, you'd find Anglican churches that would use the lectionary readings. Presbyterian churches would probably use them. Uniting churches would certainly use them. Lutheran churches, I would think, would probably use the lectionary readings. And the lectionary readings are, there's a three-year cycle, years A, B, and C. And they work their way through four readings every Sunday. So there are two from the Old Testament, usually a psalm and another passage, so one of the narratives or a prophetic oracle or whatnot. And then there's a gospel reading and an epistle reading. And those are thematically linked a little bit, but they mean that what it means is that over the course of 3 years, if people were in church every single Sunday, they'd actually hear pretty big chunk of the Bible read aloud in a service of worship and theoretically reflected upon in some way, shape, or form. Preaching the lectionary, is, as far as I understand it, is not a trickier proposition, but it's a matter of saying you can look at one of those passages and preach on it. You might combine a couple of them if they have a common theme. You might try to weave a theme or a topic that's found in all four of those passages. And so there's some variety in that whole space. So as a Baptist church, we tend not to follow the lectionary. If you've been around, you kind of know that for sure. But from time to time, I found it really quite valuable as a different kind of discipline, both as a preacher, but also as an opportunity for us in our own liturgy. So over these couple of weeks and in the week to come, we're reading a couple more passages than we might normally in a Sunday morning service, which I think is always a pretty good thing. And as I said, as a preacher, I think it's a different kind of discipline. It's a different kind of skill. It's a different kind of challenge of being given four passages and having to decide on one or more of them to try to grapple with whether there's a theme that's found within them. Anyway, so that's been my experience of it. It's part of the reason why we're doing it at this point in time. Just kind of an internal decision more than anything else. In terms of why we're only following it now, it's broadly because in our preaching ministry, there are certain things that we want to be hitting upon, certain themes and topics that we want to be focusing on, certain books of the Bible that we want to be focusing on in a kind of a deep dive. And the lectionary doesn't always necessarily allow you to do that easily. And so we've just made the decision to follow it occasionally when we come to series such as that. So I hope that explains it a little bit. Some of you have kind of, you kind of know all this. You may have come from a church that used a lectionary in your previous experience, or have attended ones that's like that. But anyway, for those of you who are thoroughly Baptist or from other independent kinds of denominations, that might be a very new thing. So I hope that clarifies that just a little bit. Psalm 82 is an unusual psalm for two reasons. One, it's primarily a speech from God. Normally, as I said on Sunday, the psalms are our speech to God, right? Our prayers of thanksgiving, our hymns of praise, our laments, our prayers for assistance and for guidance and all those sorts of things. So Psalm 82 is a little bit strange in that it's a speech from God that we are listening to as kind of our words, which is curious. And it's also unusual because of the setting. The psalmist sets Psalm 82 in the assembly of the gods, a common image and idea. I kind of made the comparison with a CEO at a board table. Like, even if we've never been a CEO, even if we've never been on a board, even if we've never been a vice president of something or other, we are familiar with that image. And the psalmist has brought this image into his psalm as the setting for God's speech. It's kind of the most significant audience that God could speak to about justice. But it does raise the question, did the Israelites believe that the other gods were real? So if this psalm was read in a worship service in the temple, right? The people are gathered, and the priest or the Levite or whoever it was stands up and read Psalm 82. Would your common Israelite have thought, oh, this is a curious, fictitious opening for us to think about God's speech? Or would they have just nodded along and thought, yeah, our God would certainly be at the head of the assembly of the gods? And I suppose the answer to the question, you know, did they believe that they were real? I think the simple answer is yes, they did. Yes, they did. And the evidence for that is, I think, twofold. One, they continually fell into idolatry. They continually began to follow the other gods. And you follow other gods because you believe that they control your destiny, right? I've said this before, but we worship that which we fear controls our destiny, or what that we believe controls our destiny, that which promises us the good life. And so you don't worship things that you don't think are actually going to help in that sense. So it's unlikely that the Israelites worshiped surrounding gods because of the cultural peer pressure, right? You know, all my Canaanite friends are worshiping Baal and Asherah. I just feel like I should go along with it. Like, there was a sense for them that these gods represented real blessing, real power, real opportunity. The story you might be familiar with, when Elijah, the prophet of God, confronts the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel in 1 Kings, I think it's 1 Kings 18 or 19, and he says to the gathered Israelites, how long will you limp between two opinions? If Baal is God, then worship him. If the Lord is God, then worship him. So there's this real sense that the people of Israel did believe that the gods were real. The prophets, when they accuse the gods of the surrounding nations, or when they mock the idolatry of the people of Israel, they often mock the uselessness of the gods. So they don't really address the question of whether the gods are real or not. There's kind of an assumption, a built-in assumption, that the gods are real. They never address what they are. They never address whether they were real gods, whether they're demons, using the cover of divinity to fool people, whether they are the principalities or powers that Paul refers to in the New Testament. None of that is really addressed. The focus is, they're taken for granted that they are real, but they are useless. So there's a passage in Isaiah 41, 42, 43, somewhere in there. Again, should have looked that up beforehand, but where the prophet mocks the making of an idol, like the actual physical idol. You know, and he basically says, so someone cuts down a tree, with half of it they keep themselves warm and cook bread over it, and the other half they cover in silver and then they bow down to it, thinking it's going to change their lives. They're like, that's just ridiculous. And they're not saying that the gods aren't real. They're basically saying that is useless. Like, it's a piece of wood with silver on it. It's not going to do anything. There are a number of judgments in the prophets where the people, where God basically says, I'm going to leave you to your other gods, and you are going to suffer the consequences of that, and then you're going to see how useless your gods are. They are not going to be able to rescue you. You're going to cry out to them, but they will remain silent. You're going to cry out to them, and they're not going to do anything because they can't. So there's this sense of a uselessness, a worthlessness to the other gods. That's the emphasis in Scripture. But I think for your average Israelite gathered at the temple for worship, I think the image of God at the head of the pantheon, as the most powerful God, the one with the most power, the most authority, and the most responsibility, would have resonated with them. It was part of the reason why they were also to worship the Lord, right? The plagues of Egypt can be seen as a bit of a an attack on the gods of Egypt. If you think about the various things that were attacked, you know, the very first plague was turning the Nile to blood. The Nile was divine for the people of Egypt. So there's this real sense that the Lord is able to override all of the gods of Egypt. And so, again, the question of whether the gods are real or not is never really spoken about. What the point is that the Lord is greater than all of them. And that by the end of the plagues, there was nothing that the gods, whatever they were or are, there was nothing that they could do. Nothing that they could do to prevent the Lord from bringing his people up out of Egypt. And the people of Israel were to worship him alone because he stood alone as the one true God. So the question of are they real is never really addressed. It's kind of assumed in the Old Testament. It's assumed that they are real. Even in the New Testament, Paul, talks about the, in the letter to the Corinthians about not participating in idol feasts. Now he's not, and he assumes that there's something going on there, right? He doesn't see it as a threat. He doesn't see them as equal to Jesus or to the Lord. But there is something that you're dabbling with that's not great, and that we ought to be separated and removed from. So there is this sense that there's something real out there associated with the gods, and that we ought to remove ourselves from them to the best of our ability. So I hope that answers the question. I think the short answer is yes. They did believe that the gods were real. How that plays out is really a discipleship matter, really, about worshiping the one true God and ignoring these other gods who are ultimately useless, unable to actually provide you with the good life. Our final question today relates to, the application of my message on Sunday. Psalm 82 calls us to defend the vulnerable. Luke 10 shows embodied mercy. Are we too comfortable in giving money than offering ourselves in the work of love? So as I said at the outset, I connected these two psalms, so the psalm and the parable, on the basis of the shared theme. God accuses the gods of being useless at the one thing that they really had to be good at, which was bringing justice, and they weren't. They failed miserably. It was threatening the whole world, and therefore he judges them. And while the conclusion of the psalm is a cry for God to step up and judge, because he's the only one who can bring justice, there is, as I pointed out, I think a bit of an implied application for us, that while God is the one who does the justice, if we're following God, we ought to be engaged in the same kind of work, which then led into the reflection on Luke 10 and the parable of the Good Samaritan, where the expert in the law asks Jesus, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus asks him how he read the law. He talks about the two laws of loving God and loving your neighbor. Jesus says, yep, that's it. Like, well done. Just do that. And he asks, who is my neighbor? In which Jesus tells this story of an unexpected person going over and above and beyond to help someone who was in need. And Jesus says that's what it means to love our neighbor. And so in both cases, I mean, Psalm 82, it's a little bit more abstract, I think the implication is very clear for us that we ought to do what God has called the gods to do, right? Defend the fatherless and rescue the weak and those things. And Jesus picks that up as well in the parable. So the question about, are we too comfortable giving money than offering ourselves in the work of love? It's a bit of a tricky one. I'm not sure that there is a definitive answer. I will say this. If all we ever do is give money, and there's never a, if all we ever do is give money, I don't think that's necessarily what we are called to from a maturity perspective. It's not a bad thing to do. Even if our motivation isn't great, even if we don't think more deeply about the group or the ministry or the organization that we're giving to, even if we just kind of write a check because we feel guilt, like I think the giving of money is a good thing, but from a maturity perspective, I think that we are called to more. And in our day and age, the giving of money does present a particular cultural challenge. One of the realities that I experience in my life, and I know that many of you experience as well, is that time is my greatest commodity. And there are lots of things that I'm willing to pay for in order to save myself time, right? Like I think about the whole movement around like Uber Eats and stuff, right? I could go out and get the food, but I could also get just about everything delivered, right? That saves me time. It saves me the 10 minutes or the 15 minutes or the 20 minutes to go out and get the food. We've paid someone to mow our lawns for years now. It saves me time. They do a better job of it and it's a little bit more regular, right? All that sort of stuff. And I think that we do find ourselves in a situation where we're willing to pay people to do things so that we don't have to do them, or that we're able to focus our attention on something else. That's not a bad thing necessarily, but it does hold within it that temptation that I never have to actually do. And if we allow that to infiltrate into our giving, that can be, again, it's not a bad thing, but it can reduce the fruitfulness of that action in our lives. If we're to become big-hearted, you know, as we talk about at GBC, if we're to become truly generous in all that we do, particularly in our finances, then we do want our giving to be connected to our heart. Right? We want the actions that we go through, whether it's writing a check or depositing a certain amount electronically or giving regularly to something, we want that to be connected to a sense of mission, a sense of invitation, a sense that God is calling us to give. And so I think we need to avoid giving as a knee-jerk ritualistic reaction, even as just a duty. I think we're called to something more than that. Giving is a great practice to get into. It's a good discipline to get into, even before our heart is necessarily fully engaged. I think there's something really powerful about giving some of our money away. That declaration that says, I have more than enough. I can afford to give this $20, $30, $40, $500, $600, $1,000 away. I can do this. Like, I have more than enough. There's something really powerful in our world which yells at us, it just screams at us that you don't have enough. There's something really good, I think, from a good discipline and practice to begin to give. But we want our hearts to catch up. We want our hearts to catch up and to be active in the giving. In order that there is a real sense that we're giving as an invitation, as a response to God's invitation, that we're giving as a way to facilitate ministry. And we know, a lot of these great ministries and organizations can't run if they don't have the money. It's the way the world works. And so, releasing that funding and that resourcing into the kingdom is amazing. The question, I think, though, gets at the issue of, so should we go beyond that? So I think we should be giving. I think we should be giving in a way that connects our heart to our giving. But we ought also to be doing. I think that the parable of the Good Samaritan would have retained some of its power if the Good Samaritan saw the guy, went down to the next town, paid someone to go back and get the guy and take care of him. Right? Like, that's still a really lovely thing for a Samaritan to do for a Jew. But the power in the story is kind of the accumulated good, isn't it? One of the questions sometimes raised by commentators around why the priest and the Levite walked past, right? And there's obviously scope for us to think about this. It may have been, for instance, that they thought that the man was dead and not just half dead, and that for them to come into contact with the dead body would have meant that they would have become unclean if they were going, we're not told the direction that they were going, you know. But they may have had some sort of ritualistic activity to perform, and to be unclean would have jeopardized that. Or they may have thought that the robbers were still around and that they were just kind of waiting to see if someone would help this guy, and then they would take out the next person as well. Now, Jesus doesn't make any excuses for these two, but there is an element that the Samaritan did take a bit of a risk in going to a body that may have been dead, that if someone had come past and seen him over a dead body, that wouldn't have looked good for a Samaritan. If the robbers had still been around, they could have taken him down. It sounds like he had a fair amount of wealth with him. He had a donkey. He obviously had wine and oil with him on the donkey. He had money to be able to pay for the hotel and all those sorts of things. So there's this real risk that he takes. And then, you know, caring for the man, like, binding his wounds, you know, performing first aid in the ancient world, right? Like, binding his wounds takes time. He would have torn up his own garments. He then carefully gets this guy onto his donkey. If he was unconscious, like, how did he secure, like, all that stuff. And then, I mean, you can't gallop down the road if you've got someone who's, you know, unconscious on the donkey. It's a slow journey down a dangerous road. Like, there's this accumulation of the things that he does. He gets him to the inn, and he cares for him. He doesn't pay for someone to care for him. He doesn't call for the doctors. I'm not sure if there were. He cares for him himself. And then, I suppose, when he has to leave, pays two days' wage. I don't know what the rate would be to stay in an inn in the ancient world, but he's paid for at least 2 days. I'd say probably more in terms of caring for and allowing him to stay, and basically opens a tab. Like, the accumulation of what he does is what calls to us in the parable. And I reckon from the perspective of maturity, one of the questions that we ought to be asking about our own approach to, you know, as the question asks, works of love, ought to be, is there an accumulation? Is there a little pile of our works of love? Or is it simply we give money to things? Now, we may not be able to give money and serve in the same organization, for instance, right? But are there places where we are engaging in acts of love? Is there an accumulation of things that we're doing, a multiplicity, a variety, a diversity of activity? Some of which might be giving money. Some of it might be giving money regularly, right? Opening the tab, so to speak. You know, when I come back, tell me what you need, and I'll keep topping it up. It may be, though, that it requires us to get off of our metaphorical donkey and bind the wounds of someone, like being present and engaged with what people are experiencing. So I reckon from that fruitfulness perspective, the maturity perspective of what Kingdom Tide is about, I reckon that would be how I'd respond to that, right? I think we need an accumulation of good works, some of which may very well for us include giving, and that our giving is something that we ought to begin doing right away. Like, I think it's a wonderful discipleship practice, particularly in our day and age. And then allow our heart to catch up, to make sure that what we give and how we give is a real expression of our desire to see the kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven, and that our actions back that up. The question is about maturity, and I reckon that for each one of us, our relationship to, you know, our heart connection to our giving and the accumulation of our works of love is kind of, I think, the place where we want to be considering it. And it'll be different, I think, for each of us. But those are the questions, I think, that we need to be asking whenever we can. So thanks for dropping those questions into Slido. I'll be doing the same thing again next week as we wrap up our series in Kingdom Tide. We'll be starting a series in Genesis, Genesis 1 to 11 after that, which is going to be really exciting. I'm really looking forward to that and already looking forward to the questions, which I'm sure there will be plenty because we're dealing with those wonderful texts that open the Word of God. But until next week, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big 3 podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also listen to the We Are The Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Guymere Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too.